Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNRadio.com/Behind the Badge.
I'm Raleigh James, and this is WGN Radio, and 888-876-5593, 888-88-R-O-L-L-Y-E, will get you to me. And this hour, it'll get you to sociologist Dr. Richard Sullivan. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Raleigh. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I went to school in the good old days, you know, when women were there for their MRS degree and guys were there to get out of Vietnam. And you would invariably have sociologist major, sociology, and we'd always say, what are you going to do with that? Well, you've done something with it, and not only teach in school, but done more. So tell me, if you're not a professor, what else do you do with a sociology degree?
Well, if you live in a society, you're well equipped. I think you've got the skills. We need people. Every organization, every firm, every institution, every country needs people who know how the world works, know how societies work together, how people and groups interact, and what the tensions are. You know, kind of what we're living through right now. It's a great background to have. For just about anything, we hear from business leaders all the time saying they like sociology majors, social science majors, humanities majors, because they're equipped. They know how to problem solve. They know how to think outside the box. So that's what we do. We may not be filling out worksheets that often, but we are teaching them how to think.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Most of us, I think, took sociology 101, you know, when we were in school. It was one of those humanities electives that was pretty common. And I remember at the time, in the dark ages, thinking, well, what will I ever use this for? And it turned out that with the advent of social media, what keeps going through my mind almost every day was the concept of the group mind being more emotional and less intelligent. And at the time we were learning it, it was usually with the backdrop of fascism or Nazism or something. But today, when I look at social media, I see this as the group mind come to life, and that's truly scary.
Yeah, social media can at times be scary. It's we are living through fascinating times. As a sociologist, as a professional, this is what we live for. This is why we study what we study, try to figure this stuff out. Like, what does it all mean, and what are the implications? And as you mentioned, I'm not too familiar with that particular theory. Maybe we moved on, but the groupthink idea, the sort of the way that we collectively don't always make the most rational decisions that might be rational for individuals, or vice versa, actually. There's a lot of decisions that might be rational for us as individuals. That's typically what I focus on, that don't ultimately are not rational for the society, for the group. It hurts the group, might be good for you and your short-term interests, but it's not always the best thing for the collective.
I think that when we were first learning it, we were thinking of more of the mob mentality, the crowds, and people swept up into the zeitgeist of the moment. And we'd see that, you know, emotions would rise and intellect would fall. And the reason I think about that when I look at Facebook or any of the other online social forums is that it seems like it emboldens people in ways that were previously not available. Now, part of that is the relative anonymity of it, but part of it is also that, for instance, on Facebook, whatever your life view is, your friends are probably reflecting that you've self-selected that group. Therefore, you're emboldened in however you feel. And depending on however that is, that can be a real danger, what people are emboldened in. And I wonder if there's much study about that.
Pulling back one step, I think we'd call this a moment of cultural lag, where the technology that we have, we've developed for whatever reasons, and we have, you know, it's amazing what we can do with the phone that we couldn't do 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
They're no longer connected to the wall, but it takes human societies much longer to figure out how to use them appropriately. Really. So we developed the technology much more quickly and changed that technology and quote-unquote improve on that technology much more quickly than we can absorb as a society. Like, what are the norms surrounding that? How should we behave with that? How should we use it? How should we not use it? You know, a classic example was the nuclear bomb. It's like we had the capacity to build a dangerous weapon, but I, you know, it still remains to be seen if we have, if we should have, or if we know really how to prevent any, you know, catastrophe from happening. But I think that the in terms of social media and the way that we have access to it, it's we are in the midst of it. We're in this sort of in the middle of the stream. We're trying to figure out, you know, try to make sense of it, and it's hard to do when you're in the middle of the storm. But I think, you know, one way or the other, for good or for ill, we'll figure out, you know, either we'll tamp down on the access, we'll figure out how to police it a little better, so we, you know, stop a lot of this misinformation that's being perpetuated, and the siloing effect that, you know, a lot of others are talking about, where we just get into our echo chamber, our bubbles. And so I think that we're in the middle of it. That's not going to, I mean, we don't have the answers yet, but I think we're seeing some of the consequences of that dynamic right now. I mean, good and bad. I mean, in some ways we are able to mobilize people and spread the word when we need to, but sometimes that word isn't really, shouldn't be listened to perhaps. And so it cuts both ways.
I agree that wisdom lags technology tremendously, and not only for the social aspects we're talking about, but the relative cheapness of storage memory and things of this nature is just fertilizer to governments who want to store every piece of data on every individual. And I don't know how much talk there has been about regulating that. I know people have weighed in on the social aspects, but in terms of a society that literally is almost cradle to grave keeping track of every one of us, is anybody looking at maybe that's not a great idea?
Well, certainly this is a concern for those who are on the right, I think, politically or ideologically. Yeah, the capacity is there. I mean, we have agencies within the government, our government, that are highly secretive, well-funded. We don't know what the funding is because it's not public. It's all secret in the name of national security. And that's an age-old question, whether or not we have the computing capacity to store everyone's data. It really comes down to the question, how much are we willing to give them and give a government? And we do. We willingly give the government power, and we give them power in times when they garnered most of that power after 9/11. People were afraid, and they were told that we have to protect you, and so they said okay, and our representatives said so, and so now they've got this apparatus that we don't know that much about. But I want to balance that out a little bit, because one of the things I've been thinking about recently is, and maybe this is a terrible way to represent sociology on your show, but the amount of data, sociologically valuable data that corporations have, these social media companies, the Facebooks, the Google, these folks, they are gathering an immense amount of data about our movements, about what we, you know, search for and all that stuff. And sociologists are sitting in the universities trying to, you know, pass institutional review board to do a small study of 12 people. You know, they have such firepower, I guess, when if that data was in the hands of sociologists or social scientists, we'd find out a lot. And I'm sure they are as well, but it's proprietary and it's in their hands, and they, you know, they're under no obligation to share that or, you know, do good with it. They can use it to sell more product and get us to want more product, I guess.
I agree with you 1,000% on that. And of course, the loophole for these people like Facebook is that, well, it's free. We're not charging you anything. And of course, the price is all of your data. But I was very interested. What you said was you felt that the fear was coming from the right. Now, traditionally, I would think that the left would be more likely, if you had to say it was a right or left issue, that the left would be more likely to be concerned.
Yeah, I mean, we could trace that back through history, I think. But in this moment, I think it's the group that has, I'll say, tribe, I guess if it's possible to say that here. I mean, the group that has, you know, latched their ideological vision or their program to fear of the state is the right. I, you know, particularly if, you know, the left is in power. But I think that that's the left, and you can see this in European countries where there's much more trust of government, and you know we see this with respect to the coronavirus response. It's the countries that have more social democracy, socialism. Those types of countries tend to be much more favorable to, okay, we're going to wear masks, we're doing social distancing, we're going to stay at home, we're going to get tested, we're going to do all this stuff. It's a different relationship here. Part of the problem that we're having as a country here over this mask and, you know, debate, as it were, dealing with Corona is that tension, is the fear. I just saw something today. In fact, somebody said, "Why aren't you wearing a mask?" He goes, "It's not a mask, it's a muzzle." That kind of sums it up. It's like they see that if you say, you know, wear a mask for public safety, it's like you're infringing upon my rights. And the next step is, you know, you don't want the government telling us what to do. And we've got enough of that going on right now. That's pretty much what's happening. It's like, I don't want to tell that we have people who are leading this country not wanting to lead because they don't want to be seen as being sort of, you know, too heavy-handed. And so they want to leave it up to the states, and they want to leave it up to local communities to make these decisions that really at this time require a collective response. We can't put this fire out, you know, one at a time. We have to do it together.
Well, a couple things. In terms of Europe and the socialism, as far as protection laws, Germany is so far ahead of us on privacy protection, it's not funny. I mean, they find Facebook a literal, oh, I think it was Facebook, a literal fortune. No, maybe I think it was Amazon, actually. Now I think it was what came out of Echo or whatever that was released. So, man, they don't mess around there. And you don't see our government going after any of these entities when they say, oops, sorry.
Right, and I guess that's probably at the heart of why I wanted to try to balance that out, the fear of government versus the fear of the private sector. I mean, we don't talk about it much in our society. That's, you know, we understand we are born out of a response to a tyranny of a state that was in control of us, that didn't give us our freedom, our democracy, our liberty. And now we're seeing a similar sort of process taking place with respect to corporations. The corporations, there's all kinds of stuff being written. We don't have capitalism or free market capitalism when you just have one or two major players that dictate. In Europe, I think they're much more, not every country, of course, I'm not speaking broadly, but you mentioned Germany and several of the larger economies there. They're conscious of that. They're aware of the relationship between the state and capital, the company, the corporations. So they have the working class interest and the people's interest and the interest of a democracy much more at front and center than I think we do. We have the interest of capital and quote unquote freedom to make a profit, and you know, consequences be damned. It's we have seen this. We're living it right now. We don't have competition. You can't choose which cable company you want. There might be two if you're lucky. In some of the places, you can't choose at all. There might not be anything because it's not profitable. And then when companies come in, or when the state or the city or the county comes in and says, we're going to give our citizens access to broadband, then the corporations come in and sue and try to prevent that because it's competition. It's unfair. So yeah. We're only looking at the state portion, which is a legitimate risk. I mean, as democracies go, I mean, that is the founders were afraid of that. That's why they wrote the Constitution the way they did. They were afraid of the corrupting power of the state. But there is the flip side. It's not just, we just never seem to talk about that other side of the equation, that if we just let the market work, they're ultimately going to be monopolistic, and they will have tremendous amount of power in the political arena and the economic arena, and that's what we're finding.
Well, it's interesting you talk about the corporatocracy, as I would call it. And broadband is my passion, other than soul oldies, but obscure soul. Other than that, it's broadband. And I am a woman who actually moved to Chattanooga, Tennessee because of EPB. And as you know, if you've studied it, it was finest broadband in the country, done by the city of Chattanooga, the Electric Power Board. And we got a gig symmetrical fiber to the house for $250 a month. And it was just manna from heaven. And of course, we had Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, Charter, and there were a few others that I can't remember who sued them. And actually took them to court. And they wound up with a compromise saying that, well, where EPB has an electric footprint, they can offer the broadband, but where they don't, they can't because they're government supported. Well, the upshot of this was some of the nice areas outside of Chattanooga, like Nickajack, it's a big dam and it's pretty and all, that's Charter franchise. They don't serve it. So the bottom line is they sued for something they don't serve. So I went crazy with this, and I would agree that the corporatocracy is absolutely a problem. On the other hand, I believe what our founders were trying to do, and I believe strongly in it, was United States was a plural noun. And the whole idea was to keep government at the local level. And we've lost that over the last 100 years. And, you know, some people might argue that there were social benefits, but there were also social losses as well. And, you know, by the way, every time you say democracy, I scrape myself off the ceiling, and you probably know why, right? Democracy is mob. a true democracy is mob rule. The majority can vote out the minority. And in a republic, well, it's a democratic republic. You know, my example, and you've probably heard it, there are two wolves and a chicken discussing what's for dinner. Well, in a democracy, chicken's on the menu. Well, in a republic, there are two wolves and a chicken deciding what's for dinner. And there's a rule of law that says you can't eat chicken. So I think part of what makes our country work is the republic portion of it that is trying, at least, to give protection to everybody. In a democracy, the idea of the majority can vote for the minority, you know, vote out the minority, we're in trouble.
I'm sorry. I was just scraping myself off the ceiling.
Okay, tell me.
I hear that one a lot, actually, the republic versus democracy, as if they are two competing ideas. They are not. We are a democratic republic. And so that's how from the founding, that's how it was. The, you know, 50% plus one gets the vote or gets the office, wins the election, that sort of thing. I mean, of course, we'll bracket off the electoral college and that sort of thing. It's not democratic, but it is. But to frame a republic form, a Republican form of government as oppositionally to a democracy, I don't think is accurate. I think that you know, we have a representative democracy. We are electing people in these districts with a majority vote or a plurality of votes, and that person gets to represent that district. It's a winner-take-all sort of thing. But you're right. There could be the tyranny of the majority, I guess, in that case. But there can also be, you know, it is still a form of democracy. It's not, I mean, I would not characterize democracy as mob rule, because pure democracy could be, you know, family structure, maybe it's some adult children deciding what we're going to do for the next family reunion. That's, you know, that's also democracy. A union members deciding whether or not they're going to accept the contract. That's a form of democracy. Some people are going to vote no. Some people are going to vote yes. That analysis of it being like somehow separate from a democracy kind of gets us away from our roots. I mean, yeah, we are a republic of 50 states, then fewer, 13 originally, but we are still governed by the rule of law.
Right. And that is a republic.
It's also a democracy.
Well,
so the people who win those elections get to write the law, and those laws are then governing everyone.
But those Those laws can't violate the Constitution, at least not on the face of it. And of course, we know the process for amending the Constitution. And yes, I would agree they're not separate. But what I hear all the time when I keep hearing democracy is we forget that the underpinning of what makes us free is that rule of law, because it would be very easy in society for the majority to obliterate the minority otherwise.
I'll raise you one, if I may, be so bold. It's not rested on the rule of law. It's rests on the belief that the rule of law rules us. That's different. That's why this moment that we are living through, you and I, is different. There is a challenge to whether or not the rule of law is the final arbiter of what we are, how we live with one another, and we're not. That is being called into question. I mean, as a sociologist, I know that the law is not sacrosanct. That is not some sort of, you know, dictate brought, you know, from on high. It is a social construct. This is something that we as imperfect beings have constructed over hundreds of years and fashioned in such a way. We have rules that say you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't, should do this, with respect to how you even adjudicate within the legal system. That's a Byzantine set of rules that is completely socially constructed. But what really matters at the end of the day is whether or not you and I believe the law is just, or whether or not the law that as written applies to everyone equally. And we're seeing that that's not really the case. And we can demonstrate that with empirical evidence, you know, all day. I mean, that's part and parcel of social science. And we can demonstrate that we haven't done that. And now people are starting to question it. And when they start questioning it, that's when the social fabric unravels. It's not, you know, right. It's not just the letter of the law. It's the whether or not we believe that this law is legitimate. And
absolutely.
If we have 40% of the population believes that it's not legitimate, then we've got problems. And it's not, you know, it's not going to be a test on who believes in the rule of law. It's our law versus their law or something like that. And that's when we get into real trouble.
Well, you're 100% right that all of the society hangs on our communal belief that this is the way it is, so to speak. And not only with regard to law, but especially in the last more than 100 years, with regard to economy, with regard to money, with all of this. If society suddenly says, I don't accept this, then we have a problem. And that's probably the problem that we're going to be facing, and we're seeing it to a minor extent compared to where it could be. And it's probably the problem we're going to be facing. So, I didn't know we were going to go there, but that's a fine place to go. And we're talking with Dr. Richard Sullivan, who is a sociologist. And you can go to richardsullivan.org if you want to weigh in, 888-876-5593. I'm Raleigh James, and this is WGN Radio. You know, I said at the beginning of this hour that I wasn't 100% sure what sociologists do, but we're talking with Dr. Richard Sullivan, and I think the discussion we've been having is exactly what sociologists do. And we are looking at this in a variety of ways. And I was thinking about COVID-19 with regard to the individual impact, but with regard to the societal impact, may even be larger, to say the least. But dialing this back to individuals again, Richard, I think one of the things that I hear often is that people don't want to be isolated and things of this nature. And while I'm hearing that argument, I'm seeing in my mind many times you've been to a restaurant and there's a family of five and every one of them has their head buried in their telephone and they're not talking to each other. more and more you see the lack, the digital divide almost. It's like this lack of interaction. And this picks up on about 35 years ago when I was on the air in Denver, I had a guy on who designed restaurants. And so this is the mid-80s. And he had said to me that the call then was for restaurants where the acoustics were louder and louder so people couldn't talk to each other. And I remember, by the way, it explained what I was feeling at restaurants, but I remember at the time finding this incredulous. But now with regard to the cell phones and all, here we are, and it seems like these people who are crying for, I want social contact, they're the very ones who are buried in their cell phone. What's going on?
They may be. Yeah, maybe they'll go to a restaurant with those little TVs ease in the at the table. That's the epitome of that. It seems like the if you didn't bring your cell phone, you've got a TV right there. But yeah, it's we're social creatures. We need to go out, but we also have these devices. It kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about the, you know, it's a shiny device, and there are people, just like there are people designing restaurants so that we don't talk to each other, we eat fast and get the heck out, turn the tables over. We also have people designing those cellular devices, those handheld devices that, you know, make it very difficult for the human creature to disengage from it. It's very, you know, titillating. It's very appealing. It's moving. It's giving you little hits of dopamine. And it's hard to put it down. It's like, that's kind of what we're talking about. There are folks who are making their living right now trying to figure out new ways to make that device harder and harder to put it down. Meanwhile, as you point out, it's having some social consequences for our human connections.
It really is. We've got Paul in Naperville. Welcome to WGN Radio.
Thank you. Good evening. This is an interesting, if somewhat complicated and widespread conversation. I just have a couple of questions. What do you call the government that is run by the minority leader in the election? Where does that go?
I'm not fully understanding the question. Are you?
Donald Trump. But he was the minority winner in vote.
Well, he was the Electoral College winner, and that's the discussion there. And then you get into whether that's a necessary component, which I have a feeling Dr. Sullivan would say it's not, just guessing. And, of course, I would say, oh, yes, it is.
No, you believe it is, yeah. Well, I mean, it is expressly not democratic. If some segments of the population can, you know, it's to basically elect somebody who the majority of the people don't want. I don't think that's a condition of republicanism, quite frankly. But it is not democratic. It is an undemocratic feature of our government. Doesn't matter what side of the line you're on, it's undemocratic.
Here's the argument. We will disagree. But see, I think United States is a plural noun. I think the federal government should have a very, very, very limited role in our government, and states should be the ruling authorities. So when you look at it that way, you don't want the populations, the mega populations of a few states, to determine the fates of all the states.
Right.
Well, we're all connected, though. If each state had the capacity to print its own currency and make its own rules, that, you know, we'd have a much richer discussion, I think. But at this, we do live in a nation that has 50, you know, provinces, if you will, and there are problems that need to be handled as a whole, and to treat it as if, you know, there are 50 different unique countries or nation states. I don't. That may have been possible 200 years ago, but I don't see that today. But you're right. We maybe disagree about that.
Right. But you're right about since the mid-1800s, one by one, we have, in fact, increased the federal government tremendously during the Depression, tremendously during the LBJ years, and in other points as well, to the point that now the states do not operate autonomously. And so then you get into the discussion, do you correct what those are framers would find to be a wrong with another wrong? And, you know, maybe the answer is yes, but, you know, we'd have a rousing debate because you'd come down on that side and I'd say no. So there you have it. But let me ask you this, Paul in Naperville, what do you think?
You know, the initial if I remember my grade school government correctly, initially the government was supposed to provide defense and had some economic functions, but I think that world is gone. That ship has sailed.
Okay, so you think the fact that has been incrementally lessened and the federal government is therefore strengthened, that and now maybe it's time to say, okay, we're going to look at this as a strong federal government and do away with the Electoral College. Would you vote for that?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, you and Dr. Sullivan are going to be on one side of the aisle, and I'm going to be on the other. So, by the way, in a democracy, I just lost. But Paul, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. All right. So we're talking with sociologist Dr. Richard Sullivan, who is just a delight. And it's actually more fun to disagree than agree, I do think. I'm Raleigh James, and this is a WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James, and I'm talking to sociologist Dr. Richard Sullivan on WGN Radio. And you're welcome to join us at 888-876-5593. And it's a fascinating discussion when we have it here in terms of in the abstract. But for many of people right now, it's becoming direct and personal. Where do you see this going?
This being the COVID, what's going to happen with the pandemic?
Right. Well, the pandemic and, you know, I think they're somewhat loosely tied because I think this whole stay-at-home stuff has gotten people in a different mentality. And then on top of it, you have the backdrop of the horror of Minneapolis and the reality that while that's horrible to witness, it's not an isolated example. And you've got people who were, and, you know, that's probably the biggest part of it at all. And when I look at that situation, by the way, as an aside, I'm less concerned about those four cretins than I am about the situation their superiors that allowed them to think that that was okay. Mm-hmm. And there are layers and layers and layers of this. And I wonder what's happening. And why I ask that question is, in my mind, you know, you're not going to legislate human condition. You're not going to legislate what's in a man or a woman's heart. And to that end, we'd love to. And yes, you can control behavior, but in terms of attitudes and all that, we'd all like to wave a wand and have things be different, but life doesn't work like that, unfortunately. And the human condition is fairly unchanging. You know, I remember first time I read Heinrich Ibsen when I was in high school, I said, my God, The Doll's House, they were talking about this then. You know, so that kind of stuff. So with all that in mind, and that's a big mouthful, but you see where I'm going. What's the upshot of all this?
Well, I mentioned this at the outset that this is why sociology is important. If I can blow our own horn, it's not my discipline, but it is a perspective that I think lends itself beautifully to this type of moment. It doesn't mean that we have all the answers. No one has the answers, but a way of looking at what's happening, we can look at it and be afraid. You're seeing a lot of that. The social change is very unsettling to people. We are social creatures. We're also habitual. We are used to the following the ruts in the road that we find ourselves in. So when those tracks, you know, deviate or get washed out and we don't know which way is up or which way is down or, you know, what's right and what's wrong, it's harder to, you know, to operate in a society and to navigate it. And that's what people are feeling now. That's yes. At the heart of the social dis-ease. But that's also it's a scary time for a lot of people and for maybe for everyone there at some level, but it's also a hopeful time. And I think that's one of the things that I'm seeing from this. Change is very difficult. Social change is difficult. There are institutions in place. You mentioned the law earlier, the legal system. We're all confined by these parameters that will take a long time to change. And social change really happens in these, the big flash points, the moments when the rest of us are, you know, the entire society is in flux right now, and something happens. I mean, these police killings had happened before, and but why did this one set off the protests and whatnot? And part of it, again, I'm not saying that I have the answer, but right. It is a combination of things. If the people are unsettled, they already don't know. It's already enough is enough. We see the disproportionate impact of the COVID virus on people of color in this country. And then that gets us into a discussion of healthcare, access to healthcare and these inequities and how long these inequities have been in place. And that's a hopeful moment as far as I'm concerned. It's like it's scary. It could go. There's no guarantees here.
No.
People have to get out and they have to participate. And I think that was what was so neat about NEAT. That's an understatement. It was so encouraging to see so many people from across the country in small towns and big towns, big cities, and coming out and demonstrating with their feet. And yeah, you're right. Hearts and minds aren't going to be legislated to, and laws aren't going to change those. But your neighbor going out and saying, "This, I've had enough. This is not right."
Yeah.
That's what's going to change it, and that's what does change it.
And you're right, by the way, that, that change is something that, that people not only fear, they downright dread it. And but it will change in a flashpoint. But I could go on and on, and Doc in Missouri wants to hang in here, so weigh in. Doc, what's up?
I have a question about this rule of law. I drive to St. Louis 5 nights a week from Kansas City. Rioting there greatly affected me for a couple of nights. It's affected me in Kansas City. And I just like both of your reaction to the fact that those people entrusted with enforcing the law have abdicated their responsibility. The first night in Minneapolis when they allowed those people to burn and loot that Target, then they went over and they burnt a low-income housing project that was near completion. That was $35 million, a total loss. Now I heard this week the total damage in Minnesota, $500 million. And I said that night, this is going to spread all across the country, and it has. And there are people who say, well, people want to chaos so Trump won't get reelected. It's much more than that. But city after city after city, some of this stuff, it's like, why not let the police do their job? And why on earth does anybody protest after dark?
Now, by the way, this is great, but you are the definition of frustration for me, because I have run out of time and you've just given me an hour-long show. You need to call earlier next time. Earlier. And
I was trying to call the station number, and then I heard you say that 888 number, so yeah. I certainly will, but this is something that I would like to get into with you, Raleigh.
I absolutely want to do that. And by the way, thank you for being out on the road. I appreciate it.
All right.
All right, so
we'll talk about this another night.
Yes, yeah, I can't believe it, Dr. Sullivan.
That's a big question.
Yeah, right, exactly. And the 10-second soundbite says, well, the 10-second soundbite says richardsullivan.org is the website, and we'll pick it up next time with Doc's question. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.